At Chewy, we believe special moments with our pets don't have to cost more money, so you can save on your dog's favorite food, tasty treats for your cat, even prescriptions, all delivered right to your door. Save 30% on your first AutoShip order up to $20. Visit Chewy.com today.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
Black, white, Latino, Asian, Native American, young, old, gay, straight, men, women, folks with disabilities, all pledging allegiance under the same proud flag to this big, bold country that we love. That's what I see. That's the America I know.
Well, welcome to this week's Behind the Curtain podcast, everybody. That, of course, was the voice of former President Barack Obama. But the reason I played that is because my guest for this first segment is the man who was the chief official White House photographer for President Obama for his 8 years in the White House, the director of the White House photo office, and a lot of other things, including being the national photographer for the Chicago Tribune. He's got his Chicago tie. He's joining me, the author of a book now out in paperback, Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents. Pete Souza joins me. Pete, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Oh, you bet, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
So I got to tell you, before I read this book, now I've interviewed Lawrence Jackson, who, of course, was one of your photographers in the White House world. And we talked about his book, which was, photos covering his years in the White House. So when I first got Shade, before I read it, I expected it was going to be the same thing. I was just going to get your photographs that gave us the world of Barack Obama for 8 years. And Pete, I got to tell you, this is anything but that. It looks as though, because, of course, you had written a previous book about the president called Obama, I think it was about a year before that, An Intimate Portrait. But this book was really spurred on by what you saw going on from the inauguration of President Trump forward.
Yeah, I mean, Obama, An Intimate Portrait was my coffee table book of my 8 years being in the room where it happened with him essentially every day. And so I'm proud of that book as a documentary photography book on his 8 years with hopefully my best photographs. Shade is a much, much different book. I was getting more and more annoyed at the way that I felt Trump was not upholding the dignity of the office of the presidency. And, you know, and I have a unique perspective in that in addition to being with President Obama every day and observing him, I was also a White House photographer for Ronald Reagan for 5 years. So I've been up close and personal with two different presidents from two different political parties. And so I thought I had a unique perspective to offer on how this presidency, the Trump presidency, is not normal. And I'm concerned as a citizen now, that we actually, most people don't even trust the president because he lies to us and he bullies people that he doesn't like, and I think it's dangerous for our democracy.
So
I felt I had to speak out.
Yeah, and I think it's unusual. I'm not aware, maybe you are, of other previous White House photographers that write such a politically based book. I do know you, that you worked for the Reagan administration. So here's the thing: if Democrats or people who don't like President Trump, they want to read this book. I mean, you're just going to, because it is your photo. So just, and what you do, we should set this out. What you do is the book is filled with tweets from President Trump or other comments from President Trump. And then you juxtapose them with the way things were under the Obama administration. But before Trump supporters attack you, well, that would happen anyway. But before they attack you on this, because I know you worked for Reagan, I want to make this clear. I didn't get a sense that you wrote this book because you're a Democrat who is, you know, just trying to pitch the Democratic Party here. This is deeper than that. This is bigger than that.
It is bigger than that. And, you know, I often say in interviews that if Mitt Romney or John Kasich or Jeb Bush or somebody else had had become president, I would not have done the Shade Book, because even though I might disagree with their policies and politics, they are all patriots. They all would have respected the office of the presidency. And this is more about the way that Trump's behaving in office. It doesn't have to do with the fact that he's a Republican. And that's what really, that's why I chose to speak out, is, I'm actually concerned about the young people, that they see people that are just starting to pay attention to the presidency for the first time. They see their president bullying people online and lying all the time. And they just think, oh, okay, well, if he can do that, then I can do that. Or even worse, oh, that's the way the president, runs his office. And, and I'm trying to say to people, no, that's this is not normal. This is not the way a president should behave. I think the main reason why I decided to do this book, it's not a Republican or a Democrat thing.
Yeah, I also like the fact that you, the title of the book, Shade, I think somebody made the comment to you that, oh, he's throwing shade at Trump. You didn't even know what it meant. So you kind of had to check that out and realized, oh, yeah, I guess that is what I'm doing. I think I'll call the book that.
Yeah, I started doing this on my Instagram feed a year and a half before the book came out. And I was very subtle about it, and people caught on to what I was doing, because I wasn't always referring to a particular Trump tweet. I was just putting my response out there, and people had to pay attention to the news in order to know what I was talking about. But people caught on that I was, as they called it, throwing shade. And I didn't know that terminology. You're right. And I looked it up, and I was like, oh, well, yeah, that's what I'm doing. And so when it came time to title the book, my original suggestion to the publisher was to title it Throwing Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents. And the editor at my publisher was like, no, let's just do Shade. People will know what it means. And I think he was probably right.
I think people know exactly what it means. As I said, it surprised me just because I didn't, before I read the book, didn't know what I was in for and that's what you were doing. And then, of course, it hit me fairly quickly, and I should have realized it even ahead of time. Of course, the book came out in 2018, right? Or 2019. You were writing it in 2018, but I think it came out in 2019. And I imagine that you could easily write a volume 2, 3, and 4, just even juxtaposing pictures from your days in the White House. I'll stop there. Have you thought about that? That there's just so much since then that you could also...
The paperback edition is, to a certain extent, version 2.
Gotcha.
It's updated, so it has more recent material. And I suspect I could do, this by this fall, I could do version 3. But, I'm sort of counting on that there's not going to be any need to do a version 3 after November, knock on wood.
Yeah, I heard about that in 2016 too, Pete. You know that. It's the hardcover book that I read, so I need to check out the softcover updated version. But what I found fascinating is, what's great about this is, a lot of people could have a presidential tweet and you could juxtapose it with something President Obama said and let that stand for itself. What's so fantastic about you being the White House photographer is that you actually back it up with photos. So, for example, you go all the way back to the beginning in terms of the president and sending Sean Spicer out there saying we've had the largest crowds in history. And you, of course, then show us the photos. I guess you wouldn't have taken them, but you showed us the photos of the Obama inauguration, the Trump inauguration. So you basically fight back on some of these tweets and some of the, misstatements or alleged misstatements by President Trump by showing photographic evidence of what was going on. But even deeper than that, those are the kind of things people have bandied about. It's the character piece of all of this. It's the character piece of all of this where you'll just have pictures of you had one page where you have different pictures of President Obama, and there was a Trump tweet that says, "How low has President Obama gone to tap my phones during the very sacred election process? This is Nixon Watergate, bad or sick guy." And you just show the president just sort of sitting in his chair. At one point, he's laughing. At one point, he's kicking back. And I think you're just making the point going, seriously, is that really what you think went on here? I mean, it's really comments directly at Trump as well.
Yeah, and that particular response. Okay, so we've got the President of the United States accusing his predecessor of a felony. You know, with no evidence, he's just throwing it out there.
Yeah,
and I feel that I know Barack Obama better than anyone. I mean, I've seen him in all kinds of situations. I always know his emotions, and I wondered to myself, what the heck must he be thinking to have his successor accuse him of a felony? And so that's why I juxtaposed those four different images of President Obama, one laughing, one, you know, kind of being really sad, because I was wondering, he probably reacted one of those ways. I just don't know which way he might have reacted.
Right. Well, but and even Michelle and Barack Obama, there's a photo you have of or you talk about the fact of Melania Trump brushing away the president's hand at one point. And then the photo that comes along with it are Barack and Michelle Obama holding hands at a memorial ceremony or something like that. So, I mean, you literally, the book goes after the politics, the book goes after relationship, the book. But that's why I say this, your purpose is bigger. I mean, I think this is really, as you've said, this is really about the presidency, who occupies that office of the presidency, and what it should mean for the American people.
Exactly. And I mean, I guess in some ways I just happen to be juxtaposing with images of President Obama, since that's who, you know, I documented for 8 years. I suspect that you know, George W. Bush's photographer could have done the same thing with pictures of President Bush, you know. So again, this is like, you know, sort of President Obama is kind of like a symbol almost in this contrast.
Have you heard anything? By the way, I'm sort of curious. I'm sure that President Obama has this book. What did he say? Did he say anything to you about it, or was he best advised just to kind of, okay, thanks, Pete, got it?
So, he was aware of me doing Obama an intimate portrait. Matter of fact, he wrote the foreword to that book. But when it came time to do the shade book, I didn't even tell him I was doing the shade book.
Mm.
Because I didn't want anybody to think that, and, you know, in any respect, that he was, you know, in cahoots with me, that he was, you know, urging me to do it or anything like that. So I have yet to talk to him about my shade book. I talk to him every once in a while, but we never talk about the shade book or what I'm doing on Instagram.
But you know he has it, right? I'm sure you must have given him a copy. You know he's seen it.
I did not give him a copy of Shade.
Okay.
Whether he has it or not, I don't know. I'm sure that probably, I know friends of his probably say something to him about the book or what, you know, what I do on Instagram. But I, you know, it's just sort of like I felt it was better if I never even had a conversation with him about it.
And what about any reaction from the Trump administration? Anybody? I don't think I've seen any tweets against you or anything. Has there been any reaction from the other side?
Yeah, I mean, from what's the guy's name? The social media guy sent, you know, he.
Oh, right.
He flamed me on Scavino, I think his name is. He flamed me on Twitter, and then I got a really nasty message from one of the Trump White House photographers the other day on Instagram, like really nasty, which kind of surprised me.
Well, actually, you know, when I talked to your colleague Lawrence Jackson and I asked him, you know, you have to kind of raise that question. You know, it's like Secret Service, right? Secret Service has to protect the president. Doesn't matter what party they are. Doesn't matter what party you are. And for the White House photographer, in fact, I had asked Lawrence, hey, if the Trump administration had asked you to stay on and be the photographer, would you? And I'm fairly sure his answer was, you know, yes. I mean, for a period of time, I would have, because it just wasn't about politics for him. So for you, how unusual was this to step out of this particular role? I mean, to me, I'm not comparing it to Secret Service in terms of saving a life that way, but I mean, it would almost be like a Secret Service agent who has to protect whoever the president is coming out and doing the same kind of thing. Would you want to see other photographers do this kind of thing in the future, even if it was somebody who was going after a Democratic president or something? Is it an appropriate thing for the photographer to do?
That's an interesting question that I'm too biased to answer, to be honest with you. I mean, I understand why people think it's wrong for me to be doing what I'm doing. On the other hand, because I've tried to make this not about politics, but about the character of the office, as you say. I honestly didn't feel that I could live with myself if I didn't speak out. That this is so far removed. Trump is so far removed from upholding the dignity of the office. That for me not to speak out, I think, well, you know, I don't know how that I would go about my business.
And out of curiosity. Well, I said, did you ever consider, because here was something else you could have done if you wanted to sort of speak to all parties, would be to integrate Reagan photos in this as well. Or was the thing is that this was so personal between Trump and Obama that it would make no sense to sort of say, and let me show you how the dignity was in the office with a Republican President Reagan.
Yeah, I mean, I've done that actually a couple of times where I have not in the book, but in the on my Instagram feed. I just think it would have been too confusing in the book. But I have done that on my Instagram feed where I've used Reagan as an example. I mean, I guess two things. One is I was not the chief photographer for Reagan.
Yeah.
And I don't feel I have as good a body of work from the Reagan administration as I do from the Obama administration. But really, it also has to do with the fact that on day one, you know, Trump was lying about President Obama. And, you know, he said that he had the biggest crowd and, you know, and he's the one who who originally started drawing the contrast. And so, you know, it's just sort of more of a natural response for me to, you know, defend the president that I photographed every day.
Yeah. I also love the tongue-in-cheek moment you have. You have a Trump tweet where he says, I spoke with President Moon of South Korea last night, asked him how Rocket Man is doing, long gas lines forming in North Korea, too bad. And the juxtaposed photo of that is President Obama sitting with Elton John, and your comment being, there's only one Rocket Man, Sir Elton John. So sometimes it's certainly a political comment, but sometimes you come at it from a little bit of a different angle. I mean, you had to spend some time coming up with how you wanted to respond to various tweets, right? I mean, 'cause that's pretty clever.
Right, and I think that, you know, if you go through the book and you go through my Instagram feed, I think that I have a pretty good sense of humor sometimes, and that you just highlighted one example. And I have to say that as soon as he tweeted that out, I knew exactly what I was going to say. Well, 'cause I knew in the back of my mind I had this picture of President Obama with Elton John, and so I that was like almost too easy.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting too. The end of the book, you take a page to basically ask what comes next, and basically you tell people, go vote, get other people to the polls. I mean, so even one could argue that throughout the rest of the book, where you're defending President Obama, you end the book with sort of a comment from you, which is basically saying, "And this can't happen again. This guy's got to go." That's the way I read that page.
Well, it's like, if you don't like what's going on, then do something about it. And what can you do about it? you know, Congress tried impeachment, and that didn't work. Well, it did work, but it didn't remove him from office. So the only recourse the American people have is to vote him out of office. And, you know, clearly, Trump actually lost the election in terms of more people voted for Hillary Clinton than they did Donald Trump. But his campaign was smart enough to focus on the right states, because in our system, you know, the Electoral College is what determines who's actually president. And so if we, you know, and a lot of people did stay home, he only won three states by a very small number of votes.
A total of 70,000 votes.
If a lot of people hadn't stayed home or not participated, he wouldn't have been president. And so this is sort of a call to say, if you don't like what you're seeing, then get out there and vote.
Yeah. By the way, I had one other. I forgot to ask you this earlier. So who owns the rights to the photos? These are White House, former White House photos. Could the current White House have tried to stop you or anything?
No, I mean, the photos belong to me and you. So
okay.
Anybody can use them. I mean, there's other photo books out there by other people that are using my photos, which, you know, they have the right to do. And his, you know, I use Trump's tweets in my book, which, you know, I'm allowed to use because they're public record.
They're public record, that's right. Well, it's a really creative and interesting approach, Pete, that nobody but you could have done because of your role, and also unusual because of your role, which was, you know, as the chief White House photographer. The book is called Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents, now the updated version out in paperback, which I got to get a copy of. And of course, you'll also want to check out Pete's more traditional coffee table look book, Obama, An Intimate Portrait. Pete Souza, I'm so glad I ran into you at the Chicago Library Foundation Literary Dinner, because that's when I got to say, please come on this show, and you agreed, and I appreciate it, and congratulations on the book. The book is Shade, The Tale of Two Presidents. Pete Souza, thank you so much, sir. I appreciate your time, and we'll hopefully talk again.
You bet.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, thanks, Paul.
So, when somebody says so, they expect to have a conversation. I had no intention of doing so.
You a Giants fan?
Nope.
Yankees?
Nope.
Rangers?
No.
I wonder if the valet parked my car yet. I didn't say that, of course.
I'm not really into sports.
Oh? So what are you into?
Poetry.
Oh, poetry.
Yeah, sometimes I even try to write a few verses.
Oh, a poet.
Such a great script. And those were the voices of a couple of guests who are joining me now. That is a sound from the show called Middletown, The Ride of Your Life. It is playing over at the Apollo Theater through March 22nd, and it's got four great stars in it. So happy that two of them and the playwright joining me now, you know who they are. We're going to start with Adrian Zemed, who we know as from Bachelor Party and TV's TJ Hooker. But actually, Adrian, it's all about the fact that we consider you Chicago's very own. You went to Lane Tech. You've been on Bozo. You are us.
Yeah, I am. And the great thing about it for me is the Apollo Theater is smack dab in the middle of the neighborhood that I grew up in. So it's like I'm home and I'm, you can take the kid out of Chicago. You can't take the Chicago out of the kid.
I think that's true, which probably means you love showing your castmates around to different restaurants and places that we are so well known for. Joining us as well is, I know you want me to call you Don Most, but I can't, Donnie. It's just been ingrained in me. but Donnie Most, who everybody knows for his role as Ralph Malf from Happy Days. Truth is, you're actually quite the singer, and you're going back to some of those roots. But with your permission of calling you Donnie, joining us as well as Donnie Most.
Yes, that's absolutely fine. You can call me Donnie. You know, for my billing, I went with Don some many years back, but it's perfectly fine to call me. You can call me either.
Well, okay. You know what? Let me touch base. Since you worked with Ron Howard for all those years, let me just touch base. Do we also get to call him Ronnie, or is he, no, I'm Ron?
You might have to go with Ron with him. He switched over way before I did from Ronnie.
Okay.
You know, but when we first started doing Happy Days, he was already Ron by then.
All right. Now, I go back to Andy Griffith, so I'm sorry. It's got always Ronnie for me, but that's me. Anyway, and also joining us, the playwright of Middletown, the ride of your life, is Dan Clancy. And, you know, Dan, there's been a lot of interviews done with the cast here, because it's not just these two great stars, but Sandy Duncan from the Sandy Duncan Show and Peter Pan and so many other things, and a local talent, Kate Boudicke, who we know from Broadway, but also Chicago. So a great cast here in Chicago, but I don't often see you, Dan, in the interview, so I appreciate your joining us. And let me ask you, the story of Middletown, it's sort of like watching, in some ways, I feel like I'm watching maybe my parents and their friends grow up. Maybe it's me. I don't know. But tell the audience who's listening to us what Middletown is all about. What led you to write this?
Right. I usually write to make sense out of something going on in my life, or make sense out of something going on in the world. For example, my latest works dealt with school shootings, sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, and assisted suicide. But during the summers, I spend time in a place called Cherry Grove, which is on Fire Island. And they have a wonderful theater there, an old barn theater that they floated over in 1940s, and it was in terrible disrepair. And they asked if I would write a piece as a fundraiser. And the only two requirements was that I'd use people in the community, and the piece couldn't last more than 50 minutes. Four people volunteered, two people who were actors and two people who weren't actors. And their only requirement was, we cannot memorize the lines. And then when I looked at these four people, the common thread was that they'd been friends for so many years. So basically, I wrote the play in which, for actors, they were in their 70s, they didn't want to memorize lines, and it had to last for 50 minutes. Now, of course, the play is 90 minutes, and it's much stronger and, I think, much warmer piece. So basically, I wrote the piece as a fundraiser.
Oh, cool. And of course, the actors in the actors in the show are on book here. And Adrian, let me come to you. You get the sense as you're watching.
Wait. One thing that Dan did not mention is that we added a helicopter, a chandelier, and a swimming pool sequence for the extras and dancers and stuff. It just got a little bit bigger. That's all. A little bit bigger.
But they still wouldn't memorize the lines, so there was nothing he could do with the helicopter. So, Adrian, you get the feeling there are times that you guys do come off book. I mean, Sandy Duncan opens the show off book. There are moments that you're off book. So it's almost as though being on book. Well, I'll ask you, Adrian, is that a good thing that it's or is it sort of like, hey, if you are, you are, you're not. You have such a sense of it anyway. It almost doesn't matter. How do you feel about it?
You pretty much hit it on the button. After doing it three or four times, we have to force ourselves to start looking down at the book. Honestly, and it's not because Dan's, on with us, his dialogue is so simply beautifully put. It's like the way, you talk about Shakespeare. You can't say it any other way. It just flows out of you quite easily. And a quick glance down at the page, and you already know the words, Dan's words. It just flows out so beautifully and so easily. But after you do it about two or three times, it's an effort for us to keep our eyes down. We as actors are looking at each other. It is a staged reading if you really think about it, because we're moving around and we're looking at each other and stuff. Not like that the show Love Letters at all, which I'm sure many of your audience has probably seen incarnation of it and all, where they don't even look at each other throughout the whole thing. But again, because Dan's words are so beautifully written and everything is just said in a way that's very easy to just already know it.
And
I remember when I was doing like a series like T.J. Hooker. After a while, the writers just kind of like know what comes out of your mouth naturally, so they just throw a few lines in there and you just do a quick glance and it's exactly the way you would say it. And that's kind of like what it was for me when I first looked down at Dan's words. It's like, yeah, I would say it exactly like this.
Cool. And we have two couples in this show. So you, Adrian, you play Tom. Your wife is Peg. And you go through some things in life. I'm going to be careful about, you know, because I think there's some things you don't want to give away. You want the audience to experience. And Donnie, you play Don along with Kate Boudicke, who plays Dottie. By the way, I'm assuming the character's name is Don, whether your name is Donnie or not, right?
Yes, that's the way it was, coincidentally. Had nothing to do with when they cast me. That was the character's name.
Donnie, let me ask you, how important is to you? I mean, I know that you guys are mobbed every night from audience members if they can catch you, you know, because of your previous work. I mean, you're kind of television icons to a lot of these people. You all are. I mean, and Sandy as well. How important is it that, and I'm going to come back to Dan in a moment, but that the players in this, the actors in this, actually are so familiar to? What if it had been four unknowns up there, Donnie? Would this work?
Well, it's a good question. I think it would work regardless. I think it's an extra sort of bonus that the familiarity they have with us, you know, the affection that hopefully it seems they have for us, it helps. But you know, it could have worked the other way. You know, it's possible that maybe they would be so. You know, associating us with these prior characters, that maybe it would separate them a little bit from getting into the reality of the play itself, and it could have caused like a little bit of a barrier. So I don't know. You know, I think that it was so well cast in terms of us being right for the parts, or at least being able to embody the parts, and everyone is so good that. People seem to forget that it's nice that they know us and they have affection and they feel really good and they're sort of invigorated right from the beginning. But then I think they forget that because the story is so compelling and so well beautifully written. And we have such great actors that people just then get lost in the story and totally get caught up in it. And I think they forget. Within, you know, 10, 15 minutes, they're looking at us as these characters.
Dan, let me ask you, was that part of the original premise here when this thing was going to go around? We needed to have, you know, sort of these television iconic figures that would play these roles. As I said, Cindy Williams is in there from time to time, I think in the Kate Boudicke role, but Dottie. But what, so talk to me about that. Was that what you envisioned, or that just sort of happened?
No, basically it just happened. The first production was in Boca Raton in Florida, and the producers, Ken Greenblatt, saw the production and said, you know, I think there's something really special here, but I need to talk to my son Seth and to decide whether or not we'd like to pick up the option on it. People will not go and buy tickets because it's a Dan Clancy play. I mean, that's obvious. I mean, I've had a wonderful career in the theater, but I'm not a recognizable name. So when they decided to do the show, they decided to go with names, which I think is a really smart. And it's not just names. I mean, these are really fine actors who, you know, I define acting as acting truthfully in an imaginary situation, and they are brilliant at it. The thing that Seth did that changed the play, the first production, the four actors just come on, and the play begins. And Seth was somewhat concerned in terms of here four well-known personalities, and how do we separate the personalities and get them into the play? And that's why I thought he made a really smart choice in which the actors come out, they shake hands with the audience gets a chance to appreciate the wonderful work that they've done over the years, and then to start with the monologue centers the audience. And I think maybe the first 2 or 3 minutes it might take, the actors probably could answer the question much better, but I'm sure they get a sense of 2 or 3 minutes. You know, they're sort of out of their personalities, who they were, and into the character. So I think it was a very, very smart decision on the part of the director, Seth.
By the way, Adrian, now that you're shaking hands in the audience with the coronavirus going on, do you shy guys shake hands? Yeah. Do you have people sort of giving you their elbow? What are you experiencing?
You know, it's really funny that you should just mention that. My wife arrived to in Chicago, and I've been talking about the fact that I shake hands, I hug people, and so does everybody, you know, in our show and stuff like that. And I'm just wondering, you know, Don, what you think too. Maybe I bow now, give the elbow a little, and stuff like that. I know it's all weird, but I think that it's becoming. You look all over the news right now, and everybody, I think, is a little bit apprehensive to shake a hand at this point. And I was actually going to start doing that probably tomorrow with our matinee tomorrow. I was going to maybe just kind of like bow a little and give them an elbow or and stuff. I don't know what, you know, Paul, what's right? Is a fist pump okay, or is that still medically, you know, not okay to do day and age?
The fist bump is okay, and Don, I want to get your take on it, but I will also say, to me, because you guys are also, you know, you're very lighthearted, you've got a comedic background, it actually, for me, can be a very funny and clever way to open it, too, if you play it right. I just think of Don, what do you think, Don?
The one thing I do to everybody is I start talking to everybody, and I say, did you all go to the bathroom? It's a 90-minute show with no intermission.
Right.
And they all love that, because it breaks the ice right away, you know. But as Dan mentioned, it is a brilliant piece of direction by Seth in that we come out, everybody knows who we are, you know, so it's like their faces light up and everybody starts cheering. How can you not embrace the audience and that while they're embracing you?
Yeah.
And it totally breaks the ice on that whole, you know, TV film personality thing right away. It's really, really beautifully done. And once Sandy's character Peg starts talking to the audience, it's gone. That whole fourth wall was broken, and I also believe that it's brilliantly done in that we immediately create the audience as the fifth character in the show. They're a part of the show. We talk to them all the time. Almost every page that we're on, we refer to the audience and do asides to the audience several times on every page of the script. So they are a part of the show, and it immediately breaks down the fourth wall.
Let me describe for our listeners just these couples a little bit. Donnie, talk about Don and Dottie, because, by the way, this play takes us pretty much from when they met all the way through their relationship. Again, I'm not going to give some stuff away here, but Don and Dottie seem to represent a certain kind of couple based on certain things, and Dottie is just this incredible character anyway, as opposed to Peg and Tom. How would you describe, Donnie, the character, the relationship of Don and Dottie?
Yeah, well, what's great about this is that these are two couples, you know, that we've learned that they've been friends for 33 years. They have dinner every Friday night. And yet when you meet them, you wouldn't expect that these two couples would be friends because they're so opposite each other. But that's what's the beauty of it is, you know, we know in life that that's the way it happens sometimes. And, you know, Dottie and Don are, you know, they're much more of a sort of a blue collar, I guess, mentality, a more telling it like it is and no pretenses. Not that Tom and Peg have pretenses, but they're, you know, they're much more educated. Peg went to Smith and Dottie went to Trenton State, you know, and they go through this in a great exchange where Dan wrote and you know who these people are right away. And Peg and Tom meet in a bookstore where Dottie and Tom would never be meeting in a book. Dottie and Don would never be in a bookstore hardly at all, period. You know, so, you know, she's very tough. She's a little gruff but you get to love her, and Don is the same way. You know, he's a guy who didn't even finish high school, so they have a very different kind of relationship they're different personalities, but they both love each. You know, both couples, the two of them are very much in love and have these long relationships.
And Adrian,
the contrast that works.
Yeah, Adrian, Tom and Peg. Again, Tom has some character flaws in him that we learn about. Talk a bit about the relationship between Tom and Peg, because Peg is really just kind of a really good person, as Sandy Duncan is.
Yes, yes. Tom seems to be the guy that Dan has chosen to for life, kind of like to happen to him a bit and deal with it. And you know, Dan, I in one of the talkbacks that we had with the audience Somebody asked the question, and they said, this may be more of a question for the author, but they pointed out that most of the tough things in life, some of the tragedies and infidelities in life and whatever happened to Tom and Peg. And why did you choose for Tom and Peg to have the bulk of all of that rather than Don and Dottie and all of that? I mean, was there any reason, or is that just the way it turned out?
It basically, when I was writing these four characters, obviously I wanted to make a play in which you saw four unique individuals. And they each have their flaws, and they all, at the same time, though, I think that line from Emerson at the end of the play about, you know, the only way to have a friend is to be one. And I think the four of them, the uniting thing is that they all knew how to be friends. I didn't specifically, you know, I did, truthfully, with writing this, I didn't say, all the heavy moments I'm going to give to Peg and Tom and the lighter moments. But Don and Dottie, I mean, they have some really tough moments also. I think
yes.
One of the major decisions for couples is, do we want another child? Things are going really well. What's going to happen if there's another person? The Dottie saying basically, you know, I'm not really good at being a mother. I'm really good at controlling 26 kids in the classroom. But unfortunately, on a one-on-one, I'm lacking. So there are moments, you know, in the play that I think it's obviously the comic relief, the fiddler on the roof scene, which I'm really proud of that scene, not only because it's very comical, but it also, it really shows that the love that these two people have, you know, over 33 years. I really did not go in there with the idea of, you know, making this the heavy couple or making this
lighter. Yeah, I didn't think you did. Yeah, absolutely. Now, Paul, I know I diverted a little bit from the question and stuff like that, and many things happened to my character of Tom, but that's what I'm actually loving about Tom, is that life happens to Tom a lot in this show, and Tom is the one who is adjusting his life in relation to all of these things that are happening to him, and so that by the end, Tom, at least the way I'm playing Tom, this is that at the end of his life, he's very content with what he's had, as is Don's character too. At the end of his life, and it's an arc, and it's a beautiful arc that I have because a lot happens to my character in this show. So I grow with everyone, and I have to make adjustments as an actor to have Tom grow. And all. It's just a joy to share the stage every night with these three people.
By the way,
Dan's words.
Dan, I have to ask you, these characters, they have to be based on people they're very Florida for me, at least as I watch it. So these have to be based on people that you know, or maybe composites. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, I never write a biographical play, because I don't know what a real person is thinking, feeling, wanting. But when I create these characters, I know what they want, what they feel. And so when people say, are these characters about you? Of course they're about me, because these are things that I've thought about or I've experienced. And some of the stories are true stories. Dottie has a funny story at the beginning of the play in which a young man is banging the pencil. And that came, I was the teacher, and I'm the one who gave that line to the students.
There are obviously
things from my own life, but I'm a very good listener, and people tell the greatest stories that I could never, my mind isn't that creative. And so someone tells me a story, and it's like, wow. I mean, I never use their name, but it's in the play. And they're common experiences. I mean, if you ask any couple, you know, to determine what made up their relationship, you know, they'll talk about the meeting, they'll talk about having the kids, they'll talk about death, they'll talk about, you know, some really serious situations that this play deals with. Yes, it is life. And
well,
that's what I was hoping to do.
It's a real just a real treat to be having this in Chicago, at least for the next few weeks. People can check the play out in general if you just want to know where they're going, where they're playing next. MiddletownPlay.com. MiddletownPlay.com is a place you want to go, or just go to the Middletown Play page on Facebook. But I just got so excited when I just heard you guys were coming in town. Number one, I couldn't wait to see it. Number two, I know you guys do talkbacks, and I hope to join you one night to do that for the audience who is there. But number three, you know, for people like me who just grew up with so many of you, although I may be older than you, I'm not sure, but I still grew up with the work that you've done. It's just an honor and treat to get to see you here in Chicago. Middletown, the Ride of Your Life is playing at the Apollo Theater, but just through March 22nd, unless it comes back, and maybe one day it will, but don't count on it, because you got to see it by March 22nd. ApolloChicago.com is where you can get tickets. Donnie Most, thank you, and by the way, I'm going to plug your new, is it a... have you recorded a new CD, the D-Most Mostly Swinging? Is that available?
Oh, yeah. That actually came out about 2 years ago.
Okay.
It's available on iTunes, Amazon. Yeah, D-Most Mostly Swinging. But I am in the process of recording a new one with a producer in Nashville, and it's going great. I'm really excited about that. And I'm going back to finish it in about a month. But it'll probably be out in the spring. Don't have a name for it yet, though. But,
all right. If you want to do that, if you want to finish that Fiddler on the Roof duet that we've done, I'm happy to fly to Nashville and do that with you. It'll kill.
Yeah, you guys sounded great the other night.
All right. I agree. And Adrian Zemed, come on back to WGN. I know you've been here, but come on back and come see all your friends here. This is where you grew up. And I'll send you over to Lane Tech. But there, I don't know. I don't know how long you want to stay there. But come on over to WGN. Dan Clancy, congratulations on just a great play. It's so much fun. I encourage everybody to get over to Apollo Theater and see Middletown, The Ride of Your Life. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Give my best to your cast members.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Thank you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.